By what authority do you do these things?
You'll want to be sure to catch the rest of Pastor Terry's message in just a moment. But first, we want to thank you for tuning in to the Indian Run Christian Church broadcast with pastor and author Terry Bailey. This broadcast is also produced as a free podcast, which you can find on iTunes or become a subscriber through our website. We'll have more information at the end of the broadcast, but for right now, let's join Pastor Terry as he preaches this insightful message.
And again, good morning. All right, a little bit of true confessions time in starting out. How many people here have stubbed their toe on the same thing, that inconvenient threshold, whatever? Stub your toe, same thing, same place, at least twice. Three times. Any takers for four? Okay. You could ask similar questions. How many of us have bumped our heads on the corner of the same coat rack, door, whatever it is? Kyle is nodding. Doesn't matter. He knows what it is in his head. At least twice, Kyle. Three. Okay, so you save me counting all that way up. You know, I remember for years in Indianapolis, we had the shower thing that didn't automatically shut off ever after you had quit using it, and you would forget about that and climb in and expose all your bare skin and turn the water on and get that first flush of cold water. I can't tell you how many times I had that experience. You would think that after a while, you would learn and you would quit stubbing your toe and bumping your head and repeating that same mistake. And every time that we do it, we have the same feeling. Well, that was stupid. You'd think I might figure this out. Now, set aside all the inanimate objects, and I'll go where I was going with the kids, because I think you guys will react differently than the kids. If I was to call for a volunteer, and you hadn't already seen what I had in mind, and I got a volunteer, and the volunteer came up, and I said to my volunteer, "Stand right here, please." And they stood right there, and I stomped right on their toe, just as hard as I could, right with the edge of the heel, maybe break their toe, maybe make them lose a toenail. And assuming this... You're not volunteering, right?
No.
Okay. Assuming this person doesn't kill me when I say, "I'd like another volunteer," who's coming? Still Brooklyn. Okay. Most of you aren't going to come up here after you watch me stomp right on the toe of the first person. In the parable that Bill read for us this morning, talks about a landowner who planted a vineyard. He did everything, the digging, the building, the cultivating, everything that was necessary to make that vineyard a successful going concern. And then he rented it out to people whose job it would be to tend the vineyard and see that it produced fruit, and it would be a profit to them. And when in the fullness of time the season of harvest came around, it would be a profit to the landowner as well, because since it is his, he would expect to receive his share. Naturally, that's the arrangement. I will come or send when the harvest comes and receive my share, and we will all profit together and be happy. And the time of harvest came, and he sent a servant to collect his share. And the tenants beat that man and sent him back empty-handed. And the message was, So here's your share. Well, he sends another servant. And they beat this man so bad that he is not right in the head afterwards. And send him back. Here's your share. And so he sends another servant. And they beat this man absolutely to death. I mean, he is dead. And when the body or news of the body shows up back to the landowner, the clear message is, here's your share. And he sends other servants over time. And some are beaten, and some are killed. And finally, he sends his son. They will respect my son. And they murder the son. They say to themselves, this is the old man's heir, the one who stands to inherit all. If we kill him, we will not only get to keep this current harvest, we can keep the whole thing all to ourselves. Let us kill son. One possible conclusion that you can draw from that parable is that the landowner must not be all that bright. I mean, Russ, after the first time, wouldn't you have sent the police instead of another servant? You would never have gotten down to your son, maybe your nephew. But it isn't a story about a human landowner. It is a story partly about a God who operates on a plane above human wisdom. And it's a story partly about the people to whom Jesus is talking. And we tend to lose track of this. I've been off the Gospel of Mark for just a few weeks as we had done some other things, special occasions and such. And I returned this morning to the Gospel of Mark. You may note that last time I was preaching in chapter 10, if you remember, and now I've skipped over to chapter 12. That's because back at Easter we had skipped ahead and did chapter 11, except for the very end, which will tie into chapter 12. So I've made this even more confusing for you to keep track of where we are in Mark. But the big thing is, just because there's a big bold print number 12, it doesn't mean that what we've read here has nothing to do with what was at the end of chapter 11. In fact, they are essentially tied together, and we cannot understand what is going on in the first part of chapter 12 unless we relate it to what was going on in the last part of chapter 11. And what was going on there was, Jesus is now in Jerusalem in the south. He has concluded his northern ministry. He is in Jerusalem. It is the last week of his life. You know the story, no in advance. And he has encountered a new group of people. He'd been dealing with the Pharisees all along. No surprise to Jesus, of course. Now he has the Sadducees. The Pharisees were widely scattered. The Sadducees were concentrated in Jerusalem because they were the priests. They oversaw the temple service. The temple was in Jerusalem. So there they are. And Jesus has come into Jerusalem. And he has done amazing things. He healed Bartimaeus, who was blind. And he's done other miracles. And he had the triumphal entry. And there were people waving palm branches and throwing their garments in the road for him to ride over and calling out, Hosanna, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord, clearly indicating their resolve to accept Jesus as their king. And he has taught. And he has taught multitudes. And he has taught a lot of things that would have been very concerning to these priests and their power. And now at this moment, he is in the temple on their turf, visiting their place. And they come to him and they ask, by what authority do you do these things? The healings, the parade, the teaching? By what authority? And Jesus says, well, I'll ask you a question, and if you answer it, then I'll answer your question. So here's my question to you. The baptism of John the Baptist, was it from heaven or was it of man? And the Sadducees put their heads together and whisper a little bit, and they see what Jesus has done to them. If they say, well, obviously it was straight from heaven. God sent John the Baptist. Then the question will be, well, then why didn't you respond positively to him? Accept his message and follow where he led. So we can't say it's from heaven. But if we say, it was just of man. John was just some lone crackpot wandering the wilderness and not of any particular significance. But now he's become a martyr and the people love and revere his name. And this is the Passover season and Jerusalem is full of people who are excited to a religious fever pitch. And if we go that way, who knows what is going to happen? So we can't say it was from man either. We won't answer your question. And Jesus says, well, then neither will I answer your question. Only he does. He answers it with this parable in chapter 12. This parable, which is partly about God and his ways, and partly about these Sadducees to whom Jesus is talking, and largely about the long history of theirs and the Jewish nation's reaction to God's authority. He answers it, and they perceive that he has answered their question. It says at the end that they realized fully that he spoke this parable as an indictment against them. And he proclaimed his authority. He is the Son of God. And they don't like either thing. And they wanted to seize him right then. But again, fearing the people and how they might react because Jesus is so very popular, they let it go for the moment. And from their perspective, they imagine they can afford to let it go from the moment. More on that in just a little bit. So what is this deal with the landowner sending the servants and the servants being abused in various ways or even killed? This is something we could keep up all morning today and all evening in the Bible study and continue going, but we'll pick just a few examples. How about this one from the 19th chapter of 1 Kings? This is Ahab speaking to Jezebel. It says, and Ahab told Jezebel all that Elijah had done, and I won't go into the actions of Elijah. They're fairly familiar parts of the story. Told his wife Jezebel all the things that Elijah had done. And then he also tells Jezebel how he had responded because he wants Jezebel's approval. And he knows that Jezebel hates Elijah. So he tells her how he had killed all the prophets with the sword. The king had rounded up the prophets and had them executed. And Jezebel sent a message to Elijah, one of the few remaining, and said, may the gods do so to me, kill me with the sword the way my husband killed all your buddies. May the gods do so to me and even more if I do not make your life as the life of one of them by this time tomorrow. What was happening to the prophets in the days of Elijah? Let's skip forward just a little bit. Elijah gone. Elisha, the main prophet on the scene. This is an interesting part of the story to me. It is in the northern kingdom, Samaria. And Elisha, the prophet, has prophesied that if things don't get turned around morally and religiously for the nation, bad things are going to happen. The nation did not turn around. The bad things happen. Samaria is besieged, totally cut off from supplies. Things get so bad in the besieged city that the king, who is already overwrought by everything that is happening, receives the report that this one woman killed her baby and ate it to avoid starvation. And it pushes him over the edge, and he weeps and he wails and he screams and he rages and he rips his clothes and he throws ashes in his hair and he dons sackcloth. And then what do you think he does? Do you think he falls to his knees and prays to God to forgive him for his hardness of heart and to spare the people the consequences that he, by his faithlessness, has called down upon them? Do you think that's what he does? Or does he say, may God do so to me, that is the killing and eating of the baby thing, may God do so to me and more also if the head of Elisha, the son of Shaphat, remains on his shoulders by the end of today? I'll tell you whose fault this is. It's that lousy prophet who said this was going to happen. It's not my fault because I didn't clean up my act. It's the lousy prophet, and he will be without a head by sundown if I can possibly arrange it. What was going on for the prophets in the days of Elisha? I won't read this one. The story is familiar to you. What happened to the prophet Jeremiah? You know the parts of the story, how he was beaten and publicly humiliated and thrown into jail at a time and then finally thrown into a well where they intended that he would just die a slow, miserable death down there in the mud and the muck. And God did rescue Jeremiah from that, but that was their intent. How were the prophets being treated in the days of Jeremiah? Isaiah, one of the more honored of the prophets. Now, this is not from the Bible. It comes from the Jewish Talmud. But Paul, as I think we will see in a little bit, accepts this. So I accept it as well. Isaiah, a long prophetic career that ended, according to the Jewish Talmud, in the days of Manasseh. Manasseh was the son of Hezekiah, and he spent the first portion of his reign pretty much undoing all the good that his father had done. And then he was dragged off and thrown into the dungeon of the king of Babylon, where he repented and cried out to God. And he was released and sent back and got to take up the throne again and spent the second half of his reign trying to undo all the evil that he had done in the first half of his reign and found that it was easier to break things than to mend them, to his sorrow. But one of the things he had done in the first part of his reign was to condemn the prophet Isaiah and have him executed. Who here can tell me how Isaiah was executed? Some of you know. They stretched him out, tied to his ankles and wrist, and stretched him out, and sawed him in two. How was it going for the prophets in the days of Isaiah? Now, as I've said, we could keep this up for a long time, so let me just skip several centuries. If you've been attending the Sunday evening Bible study as we do the comparison of Matthew, Mark, and Luke, then you know that Jesus said that John the Baptist was the last Old Testament prophet, the very last one. And between John and Jesus, we switch from the Old Covenant to the New Covenant. John is the end of the prophetic line of the Old Covenant. And how did they treat John? You know. after a time in Herod's dungeon, his head was brought on a silver platter before Salome and Herodias. How was it for the last Old Testament prophet? Book of Hebrews, just to summarize the trend, speaks about many things. And in one section, it talks about all the people who were delivered, you know, how the mouths of lions were shut and the fires of the furnace were made of no effect, and how people escaped the edge of the sword, and how women received their dead back beyond all expectation and all these things. And then right in the middle of verse 35, it makes a switch. It talks about people who were not delivered, about others who were tortured, not accepting their release, so that they might obtain a better resurrection. And others experienced mockings and scourgings and chains and imprisonment. And they were stoned. And they were sawn in two. Again, I believe Paul accepts the account of the death of Isaiah. And they were tempted and put to death with the sword. And they went about in rags and goat skins, being destitute, afflicted, ill-treated, men of whom the world was not worthy, wandering in deserts and mountains and hiding in caves and holes in the ground. How was it with the prophets of God? See, God set up a vineyard. He did everything necessary to make it a going concern that would produce the fruit that He desires. And then He gave man dominion over His vineyard. And He gave the Jewish nation dominion over a very special spot at the heart of the enterprise. And then He gave the tribe of Levi, the priests, the Sadducees, the heart of the heart of that plot of the vineyard, the temple of God. And in the fullness of time, He expected fruit. And He sent servants to check on it. What was that fruit? The repentant hearts of men, anxious to be reconciled to their Creator. And He sent His servants, and they beat them. And He sent His servants, and they imprisoned them. And He sent His servants, and they sawed them in two, and threw rocks at them until they were dead, and drove them into exile and hiding in the hill. And He sent His servants, and sent His servants, and sent His servants, and the last one, they put his head on a silver tray for the sake of two cruel women. And then He sent His Son. They will respect my Son. I'll interrupt myself for a minute. I always remember my senior minister in Tennessee, Hatley Mabry. There was a woman that got up to take out a crying baby, and he said to her, he said, "Ma'am, that baby isn't bothering me at all." And she looked over her shoulder and said, "Well, you're bothering him." And they killed the landowner's son. And Jesus tells this parable at a critical juncture. Not only has it been this question that the Sadducees asked, which is answered, the source of His authority, but He tells it after the triumphal entry, right before the Last Supper, in the last few days of his life, it says they wanted to seize him on the spot because they realized that the parable was a personal indictment of them and their authority. But they were afraid of the people, and they let him go. And I said, they probably thought they could afford to, because the fact is, and Jesus already knows, ears are being whispered in. Arrangements are being made. Even now, bribes are being offered and unfortunately accepted by one of Jesus' own. And these men know that if their plans come to fruition in just a couple of days, they will have him dead anyway. This is what Jesus is talking about. Not some human landowner who is either soft in the heart or soft in the head, but in either event is criminally lenient with these murderous rogues that he has foolishly lent his vineyard to. But a God who just won't give up trying to save his people. Oh, he put us in charge of his vineyard. And the fruit, the harvest, the repentant hearts of men anxious, longing to be reconciled to their Creator is expected. And when he sends his servants, when he sends his Son to the very heart of the vineyard to check on that harvest, how are they doing? Well, as it turns out, not so great. If Jesus showed up in Washington, D.C. today to check on the harvest that ought to be forthcoming, and let me ask you, how much has God done to make sure that there could be a harvest of the repentant hearts of men longing to be reconciled to their Creator? How much has God already done to ensure that that harvest could take place here? But if he sent his servant or his son to Washington, D.C. today to check on the state of the harvest, how are we doing? And if he sent his servants or his son to the World Council of Churches, and if you have no idea what I'm talking about, do a couple of quick Google searches and you will. If he sent his servants or his son today to the World Council of Churches to see how that harvest is coming, the repentant hearts of men longing to be reconciled to their Creator, how are we doing? Or if he knocked on the door of Indian Run Christian Church today, said, I'm here for the harvest. Are we ready? I'm going to tell you, I don't know that Jesus would receive a kinder welcome in Washington, D.C. today than he received in Jerusalem. I'm even less sure of his reception at the World Council of Churches. But that I have to even ask the question about us, and that there is any hesitancy in our minds at all about the answer, is a concern. If he knocked on that door right now and said, how is for the harvest? What would we say? If you knocked on the door of your home and asked the same question, what would you say? How many of us hope we would have a better answer than the Sadducees in Jerusalem? Then let's make sure of it. The fields are wide into the harvest. Oh, pray the Lord of the harvest that He will send forth workers into His field. And be part of the answer to that prayer. And know your own heart. Your own heart. Is it that repentant heart longing for lost fellowship with your Creator? Because if it is not, you are not ready for the visit. But the visit will come. And we must make a reckoning. If you are not prepared for that, I give you an opportunity today. Consider the state of your own heart.
We want to take a moment to thank all of you, our listeners, for setting aside time each week for the Indian Run Christian Church broadcast on this station. You can find out more about the church with a quick visit to our website at www.christforeastcanton.com. On behalf of Pastor Terry and all the folks at Indian Run Christian Church, I pray God's blessing on you and your family.